This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For Muslims in the United States, life can be divided into two parts, before the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, and after. Before, life was similar to what it is for all of us, filled with professional and family obligations. After, it became much more complicated. All of a sudden, people were paying a lot more attention to women wearing headscarves or men with dark skin and Arabic features. In North Carolina, there are 26,000 Muslims, 30% increase over the last 10 years. WRAL producer Clay Johnson helped put together a documentary that examines the Muslim experience in North Carolina. It's called Faith, Fear, and Freedom. Clay joins us now, along with Rose Aslan, a doctoral candidate studying Islamic studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Clay, tell us about this documentary. How did it come about?
Well, in the spring of 2011, we were talking about documentary topics, and one of my jobs is to come up with topic ideas. And we were looking ahead to the anniversary of 9/11, the 10-year anniversary. And this had been something that had been on my mind. I knew there had been Muslims living around me in North Carolina and living all over North Carolina. And I wondered, you know, what were their lives like, you know, before 9/11, after 9/11? What sort of issues did they face? How are their lives similar and different than ours, than non-Muslims? And I pitched it as a documentary topic, and my management, you know, thankfully said yes. They thought it was a good idea. But we ultimately decided not to run it in conjunction with the 9/11 anniversary. It just didn't feel right. There were a lot of reasons behind that. We put it on the shelf for a while, and then I revisited it late last summer, and thankfully they still wanted to do it, much to their credit. There's not a lot of TV stations that would tackle that topic.
What we talked about 26,000 people, we think, the sort of the Muslim population in North Carolina, a tiny fraction of North Carolina's population, but represents a big increase over the past 10 years or so, right?
Yes.
So what did you find? You must have gone in with some assumptions. Did you go in with – what were the assumptions you went in with, and what did you learn in the process of putting it together?
I don't know that I went into it with a lot of assumptions other than knowing that the lives of Muslims in North Carolina probably did change a lot before and after 9/11. I think what I wanted to focus on with the documentary was not so much the differences, but the similarities. And so in searching for a family, what I really wanted to do first was find a Muslim family to profile. And in doing that, my goal was to find a typical North Carolina family who just happened to be Muslim. I contacted the Raleigh Islamic Association, and they were helping me try to find a family to profile. But then I put out a message on Facebook, and a friend of mine happened to have a neighbor who was Muslim, and I talked to him, and he actually put me in touch with the Abu Hawas, who we profile in the documentary. And after pre-interviewing them and talking to them, I just thought they would be an excellent family to profile, and they had a lot of good things to say about the issue.
Well, let's hear from them, a clip from your documentary, Faith, Fear, and Freedom.
We immediately became suspects as soon as 9/11 happened, all of us. We felt like our religion, our beliefs, our culture was questioned. Like, you know, why do you believe that way? Why do you pray five times a day? Why do you act this way? And I felt like it wasn't anybody's business. You know, I don't go ask my neighbor, why do you go to church on Sunday?
You do have people who give you the comments like terrorist and what are you doing here?
These looks, these stirs, and, you know, some comments like go home,
go back home,
terrorist,
or something.
And, you know, I will stop them. I was like, you need to talk to me. Come here, meet me, talk to me, know me, get to know me before you judge me. I had nothing to do with whatever happened on September 11. Don't group me. Don't label me. It's not right.
There's a clip from Faith, Fear, Freedom, a documentary produced by WRAL. And producer Clay Johnson is with us on the program today. How surprised were you to find out that this kind of thing is still going on more than 10 years after the attack?
I knew it was probably going on, but I didn't know to the degree that the lives of Muslims in North Carolina had been changed by 9/11. We talked to a lot of people. I talked to a lot of people over the phone that didn't end up in the documentary. We talked to some other Muslim families besides the Abu Hawas. We talked to experts on Islam, academic experts, religious experts. And across the board, they all echoed that sentiment, that life really did change. And I really did not understand prior to doing this documentary that it had changed that much.
Rose Aslan, a PhD student at Carolina, you are here now. Were you raised in North Carolina?
No, I'm from San Francisco, where I was born and raised, but I lived a lot of other places. I went to university in Vancouver, Canada, and lived for 5 years in Egypt. So I've been here for 5 years now.
So you were not here in North Carolina in particular before 9/11, but you certainly have the sense of how life has changed since then. How have things changed for you, or have they?
For me, after 9/11 and since I've been in North Carolina, I'm pleased to say that it's not that bad as the media likes to portray it, actually. While there are a lot of attacks that happen on mosques and Muslims in America, living in North Carolina is a pretty nice place to be a Muslim. In general, where I live in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, people are very kind and generous. I have not encountered any unfortunate incidents.
But interesting things happen. I mean, you said just before the our mics opened and before we started this interview, you're not going to ask me anything about Al-Qaeda, are you? And I really thought you were joking until I found out that you had just been asked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
This is one thing that Muslims in North Carolina and in America, we often feel like we're on the defense. We have to be apologetic. We have to apologize for what happened in 9/11 as if somehow we were all part of it. None of us were involved in it. The terrorists who committed the tragic acts of 9/11 were not Americans. Few American Muslims are involved in these kind of acts. And so the idea that we have to apologize for some fanatics who decided to take Islam and use it to commit violence is something that for us is despicable, and that we don't really want to have to apologize because we really have no part. It's as if Christians would have to apologize for Westboro Church, whereas they really have nothing to do with the Westboro Church.
Well, and even if this wasn't a demand for an apology, the idea that you are somehow an expert on Al-Qaeda because of your religion.
Exactly.
It does strike me as a little bit odd. But the other thing is the phenomenon about just general ignorance. I mean, with a population as small as it is in North Carolina, fair to say, there's not a lot known about the religion. Do you get asked a lot of questions about that?
Indeed. So I speak to a lot of church groups, and I'm part of interfaith groups in the Triangle. And I give talks, and often what people want to hear is about the hot topics. They want to know, are women oppressed? They want to know, is Islam a violent religion? And this is my students as well in my class. And so I have to start to explain to them the basics of Islam and that actually violent is not a part of Islam. It's something that some Muslims do.
Well, what about the question of women, I'm sure, must come up a lot, particularly on campus. And I wonder if you're on the defensive about that and what you say to people who say, isn't it oppressive to women?
Indeed. So as a woman who does wear the headscarf, I try to be a nonconformist. So I don't try to be apologetic for who I am, and I don't try to show people that I'm not violent or oppressed. But just through my very acts, I hope that people will realize that Muslim women are not any more oppressed than non-Muslim American women in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Clay, you said something about looking for a typical family. And of course, on the one hand, that can be done. You can go to a place like Cary where you did and found that people have been living there in a house that we would all recognize. On the other hand, nobody's typical. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about this is that nobody represents any particular. You don't represent Cary if you're a white family who's been here for seven generations, because there are probably some things about you that are fairly unique. And that's one of the things that gets lost in this conversation, the unique characteristics of each human being who wears a headscarf and who may in other ways bear the characteristics of a group.
Well, I think a lot of times the media does focus too much on people's differences. And so that's why I was really wanting to focus on the similarities in this documentary. I mean, every time there's a discussion of religion, of politics, it's all about how are we different. And so I wanted to take a little bit different tack on that in our documentary and try to highlight what the similarities are. We also wanted to break some of the stereotypes that all Muslims are Arabs. And so we made sure to include a Caucasian. Actually, he's a Charlotte native Muslim, an African-American Muslim, an Indian Muslim, just to try to break that stereotype a little bit as well.
And in fact, most Muslims are not Arabs, as
right.
it turns out.
Exactly.
And many Arabs are not Muslim. So it's all of that. Well, so on that idea, we talked about the majority of Muslims not being Arab. Joining us now is Ali Zelmat. She is a Muslim convert and part of an outreach committee in the Islamic Association of Raleigh. Ali, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You tell us about, first of all, your decision to convert and your situation before that.
Mm-hmm. I did grow up in a very religious family. They're kind of agnostic. But my parents were very open and open-minded and really taught us to be seekers of knowledge and that, you know, we could make whatever decision we wanted as long as we could, you know, give the proof, you know. So I tried a lot of arguments about why cookies were a good dinner meal, but I lost those arguments.
Yeah.
But that preparatory work, that way of thinking really followed me into my adulthood. And I think I spent most of my life looking for a relationship with God. And I eventually found that in Islam. Not that I was looking to leave any other religion or reject, you know, some other choice, but really looking for the thing that fit most with my own beliefs about my relationship with God. And that's particularly the idea that my relationship with God is my responsibility, and it's a very personal and direct one-to-one connection. And that's a primary aspect of Islam that helped me make that decision.
When did this path begin for you? Did you begin on the path, and when did you convert?
Well, I would say the path is my entire life. You know, I can't say that there's a point at which I said, oh, let me look for a religion. I think I've always been on that path. I studied at NC State. My major was nuclear engineering. And I consider the classes in quantum mechanics to be the primary turning point in my life where I really felt like I needed to look for a relationship with God, because I think, you know, scientists go one way or the other. You become atheist or you find God. I'm really thankful that I didn't go the atheist route. But that studying the nature of the universe really was a signal to me that there's a plan, there's a process, it's just too amazing to be accidental. So at that time, I started to really think about and formulate those ideas of what I thought God was. I didn't become Muslim in college. It took me a few years, really, until I met some Muslims and started to question them about it. And their answer was, I don't know. You better go ask somebody else. And Google is out there. So I just started researching.
I suppose we should point out that we owe much in our modern physics and mathematics to those Islamic scholars who were researching these very topics while medieval Europeans were living on a flat world.
Indeed, that's very true.
Which was circumscribed by the sun. So so we should point that out, that science and God is not at all in conflict in the Muslim tradition. You wear a traditional Islamic dress. Do you find yourself being discriminated against? Do you feel discrimination?
I'm not sure that I feel discriminated against, primarily because I really stand on my own two feet. And some of discrimination is, a matter of our own self-esteem, whether we feel discriminated or not, against or not. But do things happen? Absolutely. You know, when I first started wearing a headscarf, I really took that as a really good opportunity to look at myself. You know, I'd go out in public and I get stared at every time. There's never an exception to that. Doesn't matter where I go. And, you know, I took that opportunity, you know, you could take it one way. Oh, people are staring at me. It's really frustrating. I'm afraid. What are they thinking? But instead, I looked at it as, oh, why are they looking at me? Oh, I'm a Muslim, you know. So that sort of turning it back around as a reminder to myself makes it less discriminatory, you know. But there have been times where I feel uncomfortable. I've been called a terrorist. Somebody told me in Walmart one day they thought I was going to blow it up. You know, it's unfortunate. But there's not really an opportunity there in those spaces to stop and try to educate that person. You know, if it was, I would. But, you know, if I'm by myself and a very large guy says to me, oh, you're going to blow up Walmart, I'm going to go the other way,
way. Yeah.
But I do take the opportunity to try to talk to people when that happens, if I feel like it's a comfortable space.
Probably not the time to have the conversation about what Walmart is doing to the global economy and people who are living in developing countries. That's not the right time for that conversation either. But I take your point. Rose, and I'm going to make you now an expert because you've been to Canada. That means you're an expert on the Islamic experience abroad. But to what extent Do you know if this experience is different? Do Muslims experience this sort of thing in the United States, that in other countries, the same kind of thing?
Well, of course, Canada is a unique situation where it's a very multicultural country, and 9/11 did not happen there. So I remember vividly after 9/11, there was a bit of an uproar and people were speaking about it for some weeks after. But after a few weeks, it kind of died down and people went on with their lives. And so in Canada, of course, some Muslims do feel they're under suspicion, and there's been some terror attacks or some thwarted terror attacks in Canada. I think the big problem we have right now is what's going on in Europe, where we have lawmakers passing laws that are anti-discriminatory against Muslims that really have real effects on Muslims' lives, little girls, women, who choose to dress in certain ways, and they no longer have freedom of religion like we do in America. So I think Europe is a place where Muslims have really felt the effect of Islamophobia.
In this country as well, there's been kind of a different approach to that. In this state alone, and in many other states, there have been efforts to outlaw Sharia law in North Carolina. What does that tell you about what North Carolina lawmakers know about Sharia law to begin with?
Not very much. I'm not sure. But a couple of months ago, it was Republican Representative Michelle Presnell from Burnsville made a statement relating Islam to terrorism. And then it was only 2 weeks ago when the State House of North Carolina advanced the bill to eliminate foreign laws, not specifically mentioned Sharia. Personally, I have no idea what they're talking about. For me, Sharia is a way of practicing my religion, of praying, of smiling at people, of being kind. So if that's what they want to ban, then I'm
not
sure.
So here's what's on their mind. It's a couple things. It's a kind of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which by the way, is enshrined in our death penalty. Mm-hmm. So we already have whatever version they think Sharia is. If it's that kind of retribution, we already got it. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, they will say that if you allow cultures to practice their own cultural beliefs or practices and have them, then there are ways in which divorce, for instance, might be treated differently outside of the code or the norms of North Carolina law. I mean, is there anything to that?
Well, there's a problem with this. We saw recently in Oklahoma where they had banned Sharia, specifically naming Sharia as a law. There was an article about a month ago in Al Jazeera that talked about Muslim women who unfortunately were not able to receive their alimony that was written in their prenuptial Islamic legal agreements for their marriage. So actually Sharia law, the banning of Sharia law negatively affects women who seek out their given rights in Islam.
And tell us more about this, what Sharia is and what it is. And it is not a legal code in the same way that we understand the code of North Carolina.
No, it's not a legal code in that way for most Muslims in America. So I'm not going to talk about Sharia in other countries, but in the American context for Muslims, it's a way of life. It's a way of practicing the religion. We don't enforce it in any way. I'm not sure, I don't believe that mosque would cut people's hands off. In fact, most Sharia laws do not actually support this. Only certain countries interpret Sharia law to have violent retribution. So the main issue is that Muslims in North Carolina practice Sharia law in a peaceful way. And it's not a law per se, it's just a way of living.
On the state of things today, talking about Muslim experiences in North Carolina, Clay Johnson, WRAL producer of Faith, Fear, and Freedom, a documentary about Muslims for WRAL, is with us. Rose Aslan is a doctoral candidate studying Islamic studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Ali Zelmat is part of an outreach committee at the Islamic Association of Raleigh. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking about Muslim experiences in North Carolina. Clay Johnson is with us, a WRAL producer of Faith, Fear, and Freedom, a documentary about Muslims in North Carolina. Rose Aslan is a doctoral candidate at UNC Chapel Hill. Ali Zelmat is part of an outreach committee at the Islamic Association in Raleigh. And joining us now is Muhammad Musa, who used to be a leading member of the North Carolina State University Muslim Student Association. Muhammad,
hey.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Tell me about the association itself. What's its purpose?
So the Muslim Students Association, or MSA, at NC State is one of many MSAs all over the United States at various colleges and universities. The main purpose is to really have a space for Muslim Americans that are studying to sort of come together, learn more about their religion, but also do a lot of outreach and service events. So we work with Stop Hunger Now, for example, and various service events. Whenever there's a tragedy that takes place, we try to raise funds through various events for those specific causes. But it's also very important to sort of educate ourselves, as well as whoever is interested of what Islam has to say about certain things, have conversations about these topics that people are interested in and concerned about that really touch their lives.
What are some of the concerns that students bring to these meetings and to the association?
Yeah, sometimes it's as simple as, oh, okay, how do I pray in a specific situation, or what are the various steps to praying? Other times it's, okay, so how do you reconcile this sort of weird, as some people like to look at it, this dual identity of being an American and being a Muslim? How do you reconcile those two things? Are they mutually exclusive? Are they actually one and the same? And of course, you know, talking about those various things, and I personally believe that there are actually things that overlap immensely, those two identities.
How do you talk about that? I mean, what do you say to somebody who says, I want to practice as a Muslim, I don't want to abandon my history and my culture? It's a little hard to practice here. There may not be much support for it. And in fact, there may be some antagonism. What's your advice? What do you do?
Yeah, I think at the face of it, a lot of us Americans have these various histories that we're coming from. There are so many immigrants in America that come from various backgrounds. And you see these pockets of these various cultures, you know, coming together, whether it's someone that immigrated from Russia, someone that immigrated from Mexico. And you see all of these various pockets of these cultural identities. In that same way, I feel like places like the Muslim Students Association, places like the mosques in Raleigh, in America, in the United States, provide that sort of environment where people are still connected to their roots, whether it's a religious root or a cultural root, while still being a regular citizen.
So that's what you can do for students, Muslim students, who are part of this association to give support, a little bit of advice. Then what about the question of, well, to what extent are we responsible for educating and for defending ourselves? I mean, if to the extent that we're required to do that, how much of that should we be doing?
Right. I think on one hand, I don't think we're to blame if someone views us negatively. A lot of times that's, you know, you should take it upon yourself to know enough about something before speaking about it, especially speaking about it negatively. In the same way that Rose was talking about sort of the apologetic nature versus, you know, just this, I have nothing to do with certain acts. But on one hand, education is such an important aspect of Islam, educating your fellow Muslims around you, as well as your environment around you and your community. And it doesn't just have to be religious education. But to talk about the religious education, yeah, to a certain extent, it's great. If someone comes up to you, you do want to explain to them, you know, various aspects of your religion. What does it say about this? What does it say about that? So I think Muslims themselves put that responsibility on themselves, because it's sort of an inherent part of the religion, I think. Not in a forceful way, obviously. There is no compulsion in religion, but in a way to try to have everyone be more understanding of these various aspects of the American society.
It puts a lot of pressure on you, because there are not a few college students who go to school and really don't know very much about their own religion to begin with. And so, yeah. But they're not in a position to defend Christianity, for instance, to name one. Does it put pressure on students to say, I need to find out more about what it is that we practice?
I think sometimes it's an external force like you're talking about. A lot of times it's more of an internal force. Someone comes to college and there's all these changes that are taking place, and they say, you know, I really want to find out more about who I am. And sometimes they dig to their roots. Oh, okay, you know, I was born into a Muslim family, might not have been practicing as much. Let me learn more about this. And you have organizations such as MSA or the mosques in Raleigh that can provide services like that.
Rose, you have many students who are not Muslim. Are they curious? Do they come to you with questions about Islam?
Yes, indeed. So this past semester, I taught a course called Sacred Space and Ritual in Islam. And so we visited a number of mosques together, and they also went off on their own to conduct projects. And so through this class, they interacted with Muslims, and we also watched films, read books. And so every day they would come with many, many questions.
What are their questions? What do they want to know?
Well, it became more sophisticated as the semester progressed. So in the beginning, it was more, what is Sharia? Is Islam a violent religion? But towards the end, they would ask more sophisticated questions, such as we would talk about gender, the issue of gender in a mosque. So they would ask, what do Muslim women want? So the issue of should we impose our Western standards of feminism onto the Muslim community, or should we try to understand the community from within? And so they kind of were conflicted about this, but we struggled through it. And the idea of understanding people from their perspective instead of just imposing our own perspectives on them.
That in itself is a great leap forward to get progressives to understand that just because they had a progressive idea doesn't mean they can jam it down somebody else's throat. It's a very difficult. It's a real paradox. So are there big surprises for them along the way? Obviously, they're growing more sophisticated, but sometimes you don't feel that. You don't notice a change as a student.
Definitely. I think they do notice this. I think one thing most Americans usually perceive Islam as a monolith. It's this religion that consists of 1.5 billion people, and they're all the same. What I try to do is explain to my students that, well, these 1.5 billion people are all very different and very diverse. And so we study different contexts from Malaysia to Indonesia to America to Morocco to Europe. And at the end, they're like, wow, Muslims are really diverse. There's progressive ones, there's liberal ones, there's conservative ones, and there's everyone in between. There's as many ways of practicing Islam as Christianity. And this is often a revelation for my students because they don't understand, and they often were able to understand that Islam could be just as nuanced as Christianity.
And Ali, you work with elementary students as well and secondary students in your outreach?
Yes, definitely all ages. So we do a lot of presentations on, you know, the basics of Islam and try to spend as much time as possible answering questions. Most students in North Carolina public schools today at some point are going to do a unit on world religions. And so they're going to get some of the basics, but they have questions, you know, and in elementary school, that question might be, do you take a shower in those clothes? Which is great because it means they're thinking about what is life actually like in those clothes for you. And I appreciate those questions. And we go all the we run the gamut. We also do presentations for employers, for medical hospital employees as well, so they can understand if I have a Muslim patient come in, how do I deal with it? Are there special needs? Are there certain things that I should do or not do? So the whole goal is to educate. And I really appreciate that people are trying to get that education because it's the first thing that breaks the fear. We have a fear of the unknown. It's easier to be comfortable. So, you know, I appreciate those opportunities to go and talk to people, whether they be in elementary school through, you know, end of life in whatever situation that they were in. So we use those as opportunities just to talk, to answer their questions and break that down.
We like to think that younger folks are pretty much open-minded and they will ask you very open questions. Mm-hmm. Are they also open about some of the stereotypes that they bring from home? Do you hear things that clearly have come to them by way of their homes? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. And I expect that. That's just the reality of growing up. You know, you follow the lead of the people that you're around, of the things that you see. And if you're watching the news, kids aren't isolated from the news. So they start to question, well, I saw this thing on TV where this, you know, dark-skinned looking person did something bad. You know, if their parents aren't having conversations with them about it and helping to explain that, it might be difficult for them to express that, but they're going to want to. And you give them that opportunity, they're going to ask the questions, and it gets better.
Clay, you did your documentary and focused on a family from Cary. You got around the state a little bit. Did you get a sense that things are much different in rural areas than urban areas, or and if so, how?
Well, there's not as many Muslims living in rural areas, so it doesn't seem to be that large of an issue there, although the attitudes towards Muslims of people living in rural areas is a little different because of that fear of the unknown that Ali was talking about. They're not used to being around people of different religions and different cultures as people might living in the inner city and living in places like New York and Chicago. One of the things that Ali was talking about in the education that we did find in talking to Muslims around the state is a lot of them said, you know, we haven't done a good enough job of reaching out to non-Muslims and educating them about who we are. And there seemed to be a sense of that effort being stepped up. And we witnessed that in some of our visits to some of the Muslim associations that, you know, there was a lot more outreach being done. And we heard that preached over and over again. You know, Fida, who you heard in the documentary, talked about, you know, how she's made a conscious effort to reach out to her own neighbors and, you know, talk about Islam. And, you know, what I heard universally is that that is what needs to happen to sort of eliminate some of the soft discrimination. And when I say soft discrimination, I mean the stares, the glares, you know, anti-Islamic jokes being passed around the internet, that sort of thing that occurs.
You heard Rose talk about the diversity among Islamic peoples all over the world and even in the state. And you talked about an episode that took place right here in Raleigh that talks about, or in the Triangle, a trial that divided Muslim communities over how to respond to that. And I think it points to some of the diversity, but I'll have you tell the story.
Do you mean the...
The trial.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't ignore that in the documentary. It was kind of the elephant sitting in the room right. in that portion of the program. But what we found is, you know, yes, Muslims being kind of, you know, empathetic towards them to some degree, but also keeping their distance and feeling, oh, no, here we go again. This is going to fuel, you know, more anti-Islamic attitudes. Here again, you know, as Rose said, this is another incident that we're going to have to apologize for, even though we had nothing to do with it. So you did have, you know, some Muslims who were empathetic because they were neighbors. They knew these people. You know, they were neighbors. They lived in the community. But on the other hand, you know, not wanting anything to do with what they were accused of doing and feeling worried that it was going to fuel more anti-Islamic attitudes.
Mohammed, is there a fear, a general fear, every time you sort of open the paper or turn on the TV that there's going to be another one of these episodes and, uh-oh, here it goes again? I mean, is that a kind of an underlying fear that you have to live with every day?
I guess it's a subliminal sort of fear that some people have that, you know, unfortunately, all these things that have happened in the past already, and maybe the way that sometimes the media tends to highlight these specific things and not the, you know, the imam in Boston, let's say, for example, speaking out against these events and the various interfaith works and the various Muslim leaders that are really doing an amazing job at speaking out against these actions, as well as rooting them in sound Islamic traditional knowledge, which I think is very important. Because you sort of have this one-sided highlighting from, you know, just towards the negative aspects and not towards the positive aspects within the Muslim community, it can get sort of annoying, I guess, at times for the Muslims that are living in America because of that, because people are only seeing this one side where there's so many different sides taking place.
And it seems to me that you're in this difficult place. If you say, all right, look, I'm going to make an affirmative effort to explain Islam, to be more outspoken, at least among my neighbors, about how this works, then the first thing you have to do is identify yourself as somebody different, right? I mean, the first thing you have to do is say, there is this thing, it's Muslim, it's not what you are, and then here's how it works.
To be honest with you, I'm not sure if I fully agree with that. I think to me, I just live as, okay, I am who I am. I happen to be Muslim, and yes, it has a large influence on my life, but if I'm interacting with you, this is who I am, and you say, oh, this is just a normal guy, you'll know I'm Muslim. That's not something that I would ever hide. And through that, you realize and understand that, oh, okay, this is what Muslims are like. I think the issue is that a lot of people don't know Muslims. And I think the discrimination that we talked about, it's discrimination from something that you do not know. It is usually the unknown that we are afraid of or that we sort of hypothesize about. So by just being a regular, normal person, which we are, and people knowing that we're Muslim, I think that's where the true grassroots change comes from.
Are there efforts, Rose, among non-Islamic groups to sort of form coalitions or to get together and be part of this education campaign, if you want to call it that, or at least an education network?
Indeed, we have the Triangle Interfaith Alliance, which is an interfaith group based out of Raleigh, which expands its network throughout the main towns in the area. We also have in Chapel Hill, we're just starting up again, a little interfaith group. And one of the premises of this group is to provide support, especially for the Muslims who suffer discrimination when there's a new attack in the name of Islam. And so there are a number of efforts. A number of mosques do host community outreach programs. And there's quite a lot of effort on the behalf of Muslim community as well as non-Muslims to reach out. I've received a lot of invitations from churches, especially, and synagogues. And a lot of different communities do want to learn more about Muslims, and they invite Muslims from the community to speak at their churches.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, Ali. Do you get invitations? How do you get your invitations to speak, and where do they come from?
Absolutely. People usually contact us, and we've done many in the course of the years that I've been at the Islamic Association of Raleigh. We've done many interfaith initiatives, some started by us, some started by others. But what happens really is a little bit of burnout because there's a limited number of us. And so, you know, I get requests all the time from a variety of churches, and they hear about programs we've done, and they're like, we want to do that too. Great. But I'm tired. You know, I just, at some point, I need to cook dinner and clean my house and all of those sorts of things and go to work. And so because there's a limited number of us in proportion to the large number of people, and they're out there just church after church after church who wants to, you know, partner with us to learn, to educate, we do the best that we can. But I think that we're limited by there's only so many days in a week and so many, you know, hours out of a day that I can spend outside of my normal life. At some point, I think that when we look at, you know, something happens in the news, it's not that we don't want them to be associated with Islam. It's like, I just want to live a life. I want to be able to go to the grocery store without having to educate someone about Islam, like everybody else.
So that said, it sounds to me like things are getting better. Are they? I mean, would you say things are generally getting better?
Well, of course they're getting better. I mean, we work on it all the time, and we have to recognize that, you know, like any kind of movement where people are discriminated against, it's not a short-term process. It's a long-term process. And so we work through that a little bit at a time.
And you never eliminate it. So there will always be news stories about somebody defacing or desecrating a mosque when something happens. And I guess the question is how much and how often and over time is it getting better or worse? Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Ali Zelmot is part of an outreach committee at the Islamic Association of Raleigh. Rose Aslan is a doctoral candidate at UNC Chapel Hill. Mahmoud Musa used to be a leading member of the North Carolina State University Muslim Student Association. And Clay Johnson's a producer for WRAL-TV. He produced Faith, Fear, and Freedom, which is a documentary about Muslim experiences in North Carolina. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.